Kiwi director Jessica Hobbs, as we saw through the week, has now won an Emmy for her directing on The Crown. And she is calling home this morning from London. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Lovely to talk to you. Congratulations on the Emmy, first of all. So it's been a whirlwind of a week for you. I think you're still shooting right now.
I am still shooting right now at one of our Windsor Castle locations, and very early tomorrow too.
Or we won't keep you too long. You are the distinguished daughter of a distinguished director mother, Aileen O'Sullivan, and you grew up in Christchurch. You did a lot of directing here and down under as well before you flew the coop. You started short films quite early on in life, I think.
I really did. I probably around 2021, and I got a traineeship through the Film Commission and the New Zealand Film Commission. It was, would have been around 1988. They were giving traineeships out, and it was a fantastic program where they were basically trying to get more women, more Māori, more Pacifica into the film industry. I do remember my very first short film. I actually shot it with Liz McRae and Frank Whitten, but I didn't shoot any reaction shots. I only filmed people when they were talking, so that gives you an idea of my level of maturity at that age.
There were no noddies.
I learned a lot from that experience. No nodding.
The Emmys caught our eye, of course, but you've got a list of awards and prestigious nominations as long as your arm in the US, also Canada and Australia. And although you uttered a short and colourful word of surprise when your name was read out the other night, you've had to get out of your chair and come up on stage before, or be poised to, at least on many an occasion, Jessica.
I think that's probably true, Jim, and that's lovely of you to say. I don't know that it gets any easier. They're always quite loaded occasions. And with the in the case of the Emmys, I really didn't think that was what was going to happen. So I was quite relaxed. And then I had that very odd sensation of kind of time traveling backwards and me thinking, oh my God, I think they just said my name. Now I have to do something. I had no idea that the fact that I'd sworn was captured on camera until my family gleefully sent me the clip. So I was very embarrassed.
It was quite a charming moment. I know you're directed on Broadchurch, for example, and been on some big projects, but The Crown has been a step up in scale, I think, with what's available to you, the resources as a director.
Yes, it is extraordinary in terms of its resources. And I must confess to being terrified when I first started on it. And I had, I actually went out to lunch with a production designer, very, very prestigious production designer that I'd worked with before, and said to him that I was nervous. And he just looked at me and said, "What for?" And I thought, no, that's good. I need to listen to those two words. There's a great generosity and support from the producing team, the best producers I've ever worked with, to be honest. And perhaps it's because they have that scale of budget to support them, and they assign a personal producer to each director, which is an unusual thing in television, but it means that you feel very supported right from pre-production through to the end of your post.
You know, royalty seem in crisis often. You've got Andrew at the moment, and to a lesser extent, Charles right now with the honours issue. Your tabloids, the Daily Mail, sort of excoriates Harry. But I imagine making The Crown remind you of all the crises they have come through.
Absolutely. And, I can be really honest here, Jim. I certainly didn't come onto the show as a monarchist. I wasn't even a royal follower. But I think it helped. It gave me a keener eye to examine perhaps what the humanity was for them. And now that I understand the breadth of the journey they've been on, particularly the Queen, I have extraordinary respect for that woman and what she does and what she represents, and her duty above all else to her country is something that I can't help but admire. And I feel for all of them. You can see, you start to understand perhaps why Charles might be viewed in a certain way, but then you also understand that this is someone who was doing extraordinary environmental work long before people were taking it seriously. Mm. You know, there's a lot that they have to offer as individual people, and really they're representative of an institution. They're doing a job that, yes, they were born into, but that a public expects them to uphold. So it's a there's a duality there, which I think it's easy for us to get stuck into them, and yet we still expect them to be there and be that those representational figures. And no one's asking them to go. So, you know, I think particularly with the British press, they can be a bit tough.
Yeah, we can't really imagine the UK without the Crown. So although it may be an anachronism, certainly in the minds of some people, that's part of its power still as well, isn't it? That's the interesting aspect of it.
Absolutely. And it's also, it's historical. It's so embedded in the history of this country. And who knows what the future holds? I think they are at probably a particularly challenging point right now. Yeah. But I also think, you know, and perhaps it's because I've got the hindsight and the knowledge of the show, they've been at very particularly challenging points in the past too. And they've come through. It will be interesting to see where they go from here. What now, the next generation in particular.
And speaking of the next generation, the new Diana, because I know that it's not that many years difference in age between the actresses, and of course Emma Corrin cut such a dash. That's an interesting development, and I've never seen it written about, so I thought I'd ask you.
Well, it's wonderful. Emma Corrin was absolutely fantastic, but Emma was 24 playing Diana, and then when Diana needed to jump to someone who's going to travel another decade, really, and to become much more of a woman, someone who'd been in a marriage for 10 years, someone who had two children, you know, Elizabeth Debicki, it has a different feel, has a different level of maturity and energy to her. And she is a wonderfully complex, sensational Diana, equally in the way that Emma was, but with a very different feel. It's less of an innocence. And I think that was really important to show. It's one of the things I really love in the way they structure The Crown, that every 2 years they change the cast. And initially that's terrifying, and particularly now I'm setting up season 5, we've got a whole new cast again. But allows you to jump time in a way that is sometimes harder when you're aging actors or trying to, you know, there's a life lived in certain, the energy of someone's body that's harder to portray just through aging makeup.
Emma Corrin must be a character because she had enough chutzpah to wear that yellow bonnet, the swim cap it was called at the Emmys.
She did. She was referencing The Crucible, which I was like amazing. She has so much chutzpah, Jim, and she is a delightful, brave, brilliant human being. I have all the time in the world for her, and I think we have only just begun to see what she can do.
The royal family are the same as the rest of us, just with a bit more at stake and certainly grander locations, I've read you say. And that's very well put. Let's pretend I'm coming to London with 3 or 4 film crews and my own personal producer and filming your life. What would be the most fascinating aspects, please?
Oh, my God, I think it's the crunch point when you think you've got home from a day's filming, you realise you've got a kid going to school in the morning, possibly going to camp, you haven't packed a single thing, you've got about 6 hours at home to do it. Those are the things where you think, no one sees these moments where I'm going, did I even wash that outfit for them? I mean, I have to say my children have become deeply and wonderfully independent, perhaps because, you know, and that's how mum raised us too, is it was great, you know, work can be a priority. But I would say those hidden moments and, you know, the kind of angst in the car at the end of the day when you get in and you think, oh, my God, did I get anything I meant to get today, or was it all a disaster? Perhaps those might be things that you could have a look at if you were doing a reality show.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because we only see the finished product and how, you know, opulent and magnificent it all looks. So it's fun to hear you talk like that. I know in terms of family life that you love food. Your partner, Jonathan, wasn't his mother Australia's first television cook or some such?
She was Greta Anna Teplitsky.
Right.
She had a black and white cooking show. I'm trying to remember what year it was. It was black and white and on television, and she had two little gas burners, and she wore, I think, a white shirt and a black skirt, maybe a chef's hat, I can't remember, and she cooked talking to camera.
Yeah.
She'd learned a lot of French classics. She was Jewish. She was wonderful. So yes, I've partnered up with someone from a very foodie family, and thankfully for me, he's a really brilliant cook.
Oh, good. That would save a few evenings when you come home late.
Exactly. And also he likes to cook, and I'm allowed to just sit there while he talks to me. So I really love it.
Now, you've moved out of town a bit recently, but you were once on the Portobello Road, weren't you, in London?
Yes. We live very just around the corner from Portobello Road. We've just moved up towards Acton. We loved living there.
An old Victorian hospital there. It was a Carmelite monastery, interspersed with all of London's diversity now. It must be a fascinating kind of ambience.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the things I absolutely love about London. We had a disused funeral parlour across the road, a mental hospital, which was now called a wellness centre, even though there were people still behind bars there, and then the convent, where you'd occasionally, if you were leaving for work at kind of 4:30 a.m., see a nun sit outside having a secret fag, which I always thought was a wonderful thing, with a fox standing on the road watching her. I love, there's a kind of, there's a crushed necessary diversity that comes from living in a city of this size, but it also gives you this great freedom. And I remember I lived in New York for a few years and had a similar thing. In fact, I remember ringing mum and saying, isn't it great? No one knows anything about me. They don't care what I'm up to. I can just do whatever I need to do. And it's not that you don't have that in New Zealand, but you're known, and you walk down the street and you know people, and which is a wonderful thing. You have family and friends and connectivity. But there's a certain freedom to going to somewhere where you're very anonymous, and that's a great thing.
I was a free man in Paris, that feeling.
You know, isn't that the most beautiful city?
And a great song. You're a fit family, aren't you? You're a fit family. You like to get out and about as well.
We do. A lot of walking, a lot of working out, and for my youngest in particular, a lot of swimming.
Has COVID changed London life in some ways that will endure once the pandemic is over, do you think? You're kind of starting to come out of it now. What is London different permanently or not?
There's a few great things that have happened. I noticed that people check in with people on the street. Are you okay? Are you okay? There's a kind of connectivity born from the pandemic, which I am incredibly grateful for. Another thing that which has been wonderful, which is a very Australian New Zealand thing, is suddenly there are all the cafes and restaurants have opened up, so you can dine outside. I mean, they've closed down nearly all of Soho, and after 5 p.m. you can't drive in there because all of the restaurants have taken over all of the street footage, you know, the street frontage, to set up tables and chairs and things. And yes, it's going to get colder, but just that idea of having more of an outdoor life has never been a very London thing, and it's kind of exploded with this. You know, I'm trying to be very positive, but these are two good things I've found as a result of COVID.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Jessica Hobbs is with us, calling home from London. And London and New York, I was reading last week, are still the only two, I didn't know about this classification, the only two Alpha plus plus cities in the world, pivotal to global trade, completely integrated with the global economy, highly educated workforces and so on. So you're living in a great town. It always has been. Is it where you'll stay? Are you going to stay there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, at the moment, our youngest is 14 and, you know, deeply embedded in secondary school with friends and a life. And having moved her more, you know, a number of times before, I think it would be great if she can complete that. So I think that gives us a few years. We're very, very happy here. Jonathan actually went to film school here and lived here for 15 years and has a whole family here that we're very close to. And one of my sisters, Rebecca, lives here. So we have a lot of family and a lot of kind of support around us. And we're both very energized by being so close to Europe. It's a wonderful thing. But it would be hard for me to put into words how much I miss New Zealand, how much I miss the people, how much I miss the land and the light. And I think that's been really, oh, I'm going to get a little bit emotional. That's been become much more profound and kind of frontal, knowing that we can't get there. And so, you know, in the short term, yes, we're definitely here. In the long term, I'm not sure.
Yeah, understand. Your mum and your siblings, Rebecca, but Chris and Katrina, have all been actors and performers, you know, Shortland Street, Dancing with the Stars. You're a bit of a royal family yourself. Was it in your genes?
I don't know. I think, you know, do you just do what you're surrounded by? I do remember being young and seeing mum reading scripts one night. I was probably only about 11 or 12 and thinking, wow, imagine if that was a job you could do. I was an avid reader. It was just a life that really excited perhaps all of us. And, you know, we had wonderful access to it. We were surrounded by performers and people. We had that kind of backstage access where you got to watch people perform, and we were very engaged by it. And you know, it was mum's life and something that we all got to share in. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think I ever wanted to do anything else. I just didn't know whether I would ever get to actually be a director. It felt scarily unattainable when I was young. But when I look back now, I actually started much younger than I probably realized at the time. I just had wanted to do it for so long.
Well, it's gone from scarily unattainable to your being the first director on the crown from one of the colonies. Can I ask you a little bit about more about the crown? Were you sad to see Philip go, Prince Philip in real life? Because you directed the moon landing episode where he meets the Apollo 11 astronauts in a deliberately awkward sort of scene because they're his heroes and we see his frustrations at his own circumscribed reality. I mean, congratulations on those scenes. What are you proudest
Thank
of
you.
from your time on the Crown? What are you proudest of so far?
I think, Jim, perhaps the moment I'm proudest of is I did an episode in season 4 with Helena about the Queen's lost cousins, which was a true story. And when we went to cast it, I spoke very passionately and got a lot of support from the producers, even though there was great concern, that I wanted to cast real people in those roles. People who perhaps had experienced those institutions and were, you know, challenged in their development and challenged as adults in their development. And even though there was a great deal of anxiety around that and how we would make that work, we found these people, and it were probably two of the best days of my directing life. It was extraordinary. The joy of these people who wanted to perform, who wanted to be on camera, but who also were simultaneously responding to an environment that we'd built for them that represented institutions that they'd been made to live in. And there was something about their response at the end of those days and the crew's response towards them that I'll never forget. And I just think it's so important to break down these barriers of everyone's able to do it. Everyone is able to perform if they want to and to show that part of themselves. And I'm just very proud of what those women and particularly the people in those scenes achieved, and the joy within them for doing it.
One more scene. I bet you've thought a lot about Diana and maybe about Margaret Thatcher. You directed the episode with the Thatcher denouement in it once she had lost power. And I imagine you think about them and many others, in fact, beyond all the usual cliches that are trotted out about them. What you do is a lot about capturing nuance and paradox and contradiction, and that is hard.
It's very hard, and you also don't want to flinch away from, you know, the internal ugliness that we all have access to, and we can all represent at different times. And I felt that particularly in that theme with where Thatcher realizes that if she lets go, if she stops fighting, that she doesn't know who she will be, if anything. Yeah. But I felt it was really important that the Queen didn't necessarily empathize with that, that she views it as a job, and when the job is over, you walk away. And I liked, again, the discomfort of that. I really was very moved by the way Gillian pushed herself through that, or pushed Thatcher through that scene. I found that really quite extraordinary. And often as a director, your job is to get out of the way, you know, to let the performer do what is bubbling up inside them and not stop it or try and shape it. Just let all the messiness that is bubbling up come out. Because I think that's what an audience finds most moving and most relatable. They can see that it's not entirely in control, and that's when it gets very exciting to watch.
These are good insights. Those of us who are old enough remember where we were when Diana died, of course. And I think you were flying into London. Weren't you flying into London?
I was. I landed in London, and the pilot came over, you know, the plane's loudspeaker, and said, "We've had some very sad news. The Princess of Wales has been in a car accident, in an accident in Paris," I think he said, "and she's in a critical condition." That was the first news. And just the ripple that went through the plane, Jim, was, you just kind of thought, oh my God. And it's all anybody could talk about, through going through immigration and customs and getting into a taxi to go in, and the taxi driver was playing it. And by the time I got in, it was one of those early flights, we arrive at like 5:30 in the morning, and I was staying with my friend Kerry Fox, and I remember her opening the door kind of blary-eyed, and I said, "You've got to turn the television on. Diana's been in an accident." And we turned it on to discover that she'd died.
Mm.
Yeah, very shocking, very shocking. And then also over the next few days, walking around Kensington Palace and just seeing this unbelievable tsunami of grief that seemed to affect everybody around there, and that, you know, the flowers coming out and people not knowing how to express themselves. And it was one of those periods in history, I guess. I find it very ironic that I end up over here telling that story. You know, it's exactly a strange thing in life.
It's very strange revisitation for you. Well, I know it's getting on a bit where you are in terms of being late at night. You're feeling the tyranny of distance during COVID. Could be a while yet. Nevertheless, congratulations on the Emmy, even though you can't come home and see everybody you want to see. All the best for the new season and all the shooting seasons to come, not just on The Crown. So might you receive a royal honour now and actually meet the Queen now that you've got the Emmy?
I don't know. I don't know that the royal family love us that much. I don't know. I don't know how that works at all. I know Olivia, when she got hers, was worried about making eye contact at one point, but no, it was all fine. It was very good. They're very good people. I don't know. I am really just basking in the glow of Sunday night, and there's been an enormously warm reception. And I've been absolutely thrilled to see my mum's name in a lot of papers. And, yes, you know, as she said the other night, she said, "Do you know?" She said, "Apparently I've had a distinguished career." And I said, "Mum, you have had such a distinguished career." It's just lovely that light's being shone back on you. So it's been really nice.
Yeah, that's been a really nice aspect. Great to talk to you. Thank you for giving us the time too. And very nice to catch up.
Lovely to talk to you, Jim. Thank you.